Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. In 50 BC, the great Roman statesman Cicero expressed a thought that has been echoed across millennia by some of history's best thinkers and scientists. Quote, "The celestial order and beauty of the universe compel me to admit that there is some excellent and eternal being who deserves the respect and homage of men." But that view was challenged in the last few hundred years, epitomized by the assertion of the evolutionary biologist and atheism proselytizer Richard Dawkins, who has claimed the universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Since the time of Charles Darwin, the predominant philosophical approach within the scientific establishment supported the Dawkins perspective, but that consensus has crumbled. Today, the view that there is an intelligence behind existence, a creator, is receiving ever greater acceptance in the scientific community. My colleague and friend, Dr. Stephen P. Meyer, is the most prominent advocate for what is known as intelligent design. Meyer is the author of The God Hypothesis, which presents at length the extensive scientific evidence pointing toward a transcendent mind as having created the universe. Now a new feature-length documentary, The Story of Everything, brings that argument to the big screen and is now available on Amazon Prime. Meyer is with me today to discuss the documentary and share his perspectives. Meyer is the director of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. He received his PhD in philosophy of science from the University of Cambridge and is a former geophysicist and college professor. In addition to the God Hypothesis, Meyer authored Signature in the Cell, which was named a Book of the Year for 2009 by the Times of London, and Darwin's Doubt. Meyer has also published editorials in national newspapers, such as the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, and the Los Angeles Times. He has appeared on national television and radio programs, such as NBC Nightly News, ABC Nightly News, CBS Sunday Morning, Nightline, and Good Morning America. He was recently seen by millions of viewers in an extended interview on the Joe Rogan podcast. Meyer is making his third appearance on this program. Steve, welcome back to Humanize.
It's always good to be with you, Wesley. Thanks for having me.
You majored in the philosophy of science. Some people, you know, might be surprised that there's such a thing. Isn't science supposed to be value neutral and interested in the facts and only the facts?
Well, science makes claims about reality, and philosophy is also concerned about claims about reality. There's a discipline of philosophy called metaphysics, which is the division of philosophy that's concerned precisely about what is really real. And it used to be that scientists were called natural philosophers. They were concerned about claims about the natural world. And turning that around, many scientific theories have larger, what we would call philosophical or even religious implications or anti-religious implications, depending on your perspective. So there are deep questions in science that end up trending towards the philosophical disciplines. And there's a whole division of study now called the history and philosophy of science concerned with those kinds of questions.
My understanding of the scientific method is that it is a requirement to look for a naturalistic reason for various facts that you're trying to elucidate. Is that right, or has that changed?
Well, that's a contentious proposition. For much of the history of science, scientists made design arguments as part of their scientific work. And those kinds of arguments clearly were affirming something non-naturalistic, something, an agent causation or an immaterial mind as having played a role in the origin of things. And that the argument for design is coming back because of developments in science. And that's leading to many scientists challenging that rule that you mentioned. That's not a rule of method. That's a kind of convention that emerged in the late 19th century. The scientific method or methods involve rules of reasoning, but that is a rule that says, that determines, that tells scientists what they can consider as a possible explanation from the outset before they've even looked at any evidence and applied any scientific method of reasoning. It has a name in philosophy and in science. It's called the rule of methodological naturalism, that if you're going to be a scientist, you must limit yourself to strictly materialistic explanations for everything, including things like the human mind, the origin of life, and the origin of the universe. But it may well be that those sorts of questions require something beyond the material to adequately explain the phenomena that we see. And that's, in fact, what we argue in making our case for intelligent design, that not only does the evidence point to an immaterial mind as having played a role in the origin of life in the universe, but that we must be open to that if we're to follow the evidence wherever it leads.
Yeah, it seems to me that's the point of science. You follow the evidence wherever it leads. And if it leads to places that are, quote, not naturalistic, well, then you go there.
Exactly. An example I like to give is the famous Rosetta Stone in the British Museum. If you walk into the British Museum and you go and you look at the Rosetta Stone, and you see those inscriptions, the two different Egyptian scripts and the Greek script, and you apply the rule of methodological naturalism or methodological materialism to that, you'd have to find a materialistic cause for the origin of the information inscribed on the rocks. And so you might search in vain, but ultimately come up with something like wind and erosion, when we all know a much better explanation is that an intelligent scribe, a mind, played a role in the origin of that informational script. Why is that a better explanation? Well, because we know from our uniform and repeated experience, which is the true basis of all scientific reasoning, that it takes a mind to generate information. That's what we know from our experience. And that's the same kind of inference we're making when it comes to the origin of life. When we look inside the cell, we find that we have an exquisite realm of digital and nanotechnology. The digital technology is, in fact, the information that is stored in the DNA and RNA molecules. We know that the kind of information that's present in those molecules in every other realm of experience always arises from an intelligent source. So the information from that kind of what's called specified information back to a mind is underscored by our uniform and repeated experience. In other words, it's well-justified inference. It violates the rule of methodological materialism, but that's because the rule is restrictive and keeps us from following the evidence where it most logically leads.
Very quickly, describe the work of the Center for Science and Culture and why you helped found it.
Yeah, right. Well, there's a growing number of scientists all around the world who are interested in the evidence for design that we're finding in life and the universe. And that's arising in many different fields of science. And so we have stitched together quite an impressive network of such people, and many of them are directly affiliated with the Discovery Institute. We have a program there called the Center for Science and Culture, which is explicitly challenging the materialistic understanding of science and instead showing that there is a broadly theistic understanding of what's being discovered in the natural sciences that fits much better with the scientific evidence.
When you say theistic, you're not saying Christian. You're saying that there's a creator.
Yeah, exactly. Broadly theistic. You have Jewish theists, you have Christian theists, you have Islamic theists, you have non-religious theists, people who believe that there is some kind of transcendent mind behind the universe, which is also active in the creation and helps to explain the evidence for intelligent design that we see either in life or in physics or in the universe itself as a whole.
And you've got Cicero on your side.
Cicero was not a Christian. He was a Roman, a pre-Christian Roman. But there were many enlightened Greeks and Roman scholars who saw that the natural world was pointing to some sort of transcendent mind behind everything that we see. This is an ancient debate, by the way. It goes back to the ancient Greeks with the materialists like Democritus and the atomists, but also then on the other side, people like Plato and Aristotle who were who favored the mind-first view of reality.
Let's start with some basics. What qualifies as, quote, science, close quote?
Well, that's actually turns out to be a very difficult question to answer. Philosophers of science have been debating about that. It leads into something called the demarcation question. It turns out that the methods that are used in good scientific reasoning are also used in good historical reasoning. They're also used in good philosophical reasoning. You also find them used by philosophers of religion. One of those methods is something that I have specialized in characterizing. It's called the method of inferring to the best explanation, or sometimes called the method of multiple competing hypotheses. It's turned out to be very difficult to draw a firm line of demarcation between good scientific reasoning and good reasoning in other fields, including philosophy and religion. And so the ability to define what is science from what is not science, what is something else, has turned out to be very difficult to do on methodological grounds. I think you can make a reasonably common sense demarcation based on just the object of interest of what are you studying? What's the subject matter? Biologists are studying life. Physicists are discovering the physical processes that perhaps underlie life and everything else. So we can distinguish physics from biology. Philosophers might be asking questions about, well, how did life in the universe come to be? But it turns out that scientists ask those questions as well. And so there's actually a realm of inquiry that I call historical scientific reasoning. This is what my PhD thesis was about. And historical science involves empirical methods of testing and evaluation, of observation. It involves looking at life and the physical universe, but it also may draw conclusions that are supportive of religious belief, or maybe others may argue it. Careful observation of life in the universe imply things that support a more materialistic worldview. Well, there you have the kind of debates that emerge out of discussions of biological and cosmological origins, and they're really difficult to characterize as to whether they're just scientific or whether they're also metaphysical and religious in character. I think they're all of the above. And because you're trying to reconstruct something that happened a long time ago, they're also historical in nature. So there's a mode of inquiry that I've characterized as historical scientific inquiry, which is based on empirical observations in the natural sciences, but inevitably leads to discussions and has implications for larger metaphysical considerations.
So social science, the hard physical sciences, religious and philosophy tend to blend in certain areas of what we're discussing.
Of inquiry. Yeah, really, these are artificial divisions that we've made, and nature and reality don't present those divisions. Those are things that humans have come up with. They're reasonably helpful to define fields of study, but they shouldn't prevent us from considering the big questions that arise in any discipline, and we need to follow the evidence wherever they lead. That's why we're critical, again, of this idea of methodological materialism. Who said that materialism was the right answer from the outset? We need to look at the evidence to see whether what we're looking at in life supports a materialistic origin story or an intelligent design explanation of the facts.
Do your best to be objective about this. How would you describe or define materialism?
Well, it's fairly easy to be objective. I think most scholars would define materialism as the idea that matter and energy are the things from which everything else comes. They are the ultimate explanatory entities in the universe. They're as philosophers sometimes talk about the ontological ground of all being, or worldview scholars will talk about the prime reality, the thing or the entity or the process from which everything else comes. Materialism is the idea that matter and energy are the things from which everything else comes. Everything else has been produced by matter and energy organizing themselves into higher level structures. Even our human thinking is a product, or what's sometimes called an epiphenomenon, of underlying materialistic processes. In particular, in this case, that would be something like the electrical chemical impulses in the synapses of our brains produce our thoughts, that type of idea.
And that approach would say that not only is everything flow from that, but that's all that exists.
That's all that exists. That is the fundamental reality. Even our mental conscious agency is ultimately going to decompose when our bodies decompose. And when we get to a point of the universe having heat death, all that will be left is cold, dark matter. So the universe begins in a state of it begins in a material substrate, and it ends in the material substrate with
and it exists only within that material substrate.
Only within that material frame where matter and energy are interchangeable given Einstein's physics.
We're going to get into Einstein's physics, which is way over my head, but I want to have one last question and then I want to get into the film. Often intelligent design is denigrated by materialists, if you will, as being, quote, creationism. I have always viewed intelligent design as a scientific hypothesis that is being analyzed and tested and so forth. How does ID, if you will, differ from creationism?
Right. And when scientists make that equation, they're invoking creationism as a pejorative term, one which is associated with the idea that the earth is very young, a view that's derived from a literal reading of the Genesis account that takes the days of Genesis to be 6 24-hour periods. And so with the term creationism used in that context is freighted with a kind of disreputable baggage. And the use of creationism to the equation of creationism with intelligent design is meant to stigmatize intelligent design by equating ID with those specific creationist beliefs. Creationism and intelligent design differ in two fundamental ways. At least creationism so defined. First of all, intelligent design is an age-neutral theory. It's arguing that there are certain features of life in the universe that are best explained by the evidence that we find in the natural world, whether it's the miniature machines inside cells or the digital code inside cells or the evidence we have of the fine tuning of the laws and constants of physics and the initial conditions of the universe or the evidence that we have for a beginning to the universe or many other classes of evidence. So it's a theory that's based on scientific evidence. It's an inference to the intelligent design is not a deduction from religious authority. It's not based on a biblical text. It's rather an inference from biological, physical, and cosmological evidence. Secondly, it's age neutral. It doesn't affirm that the life in the universe are very young. Most proponents of intelligent design hold that the universe is very old, but there are young Earth creationists who also see evidence of intelligent design, and so there can be some overlap there.
I've always, and when I've talked to people who have identified themselves as creationists, they come with the conclusion first, which is that, let's say, the Genesis story is true, and then they seek evidence to prove that claim, whereas ID is not doing that. Would that be accurate?
I think that's right. That's why I say the conclusion of intelligent design is derived. It's an inference from observations in the biological, physical, or cosmological realms. So it's moving from the evidence to a conclusion of design without necessarily affirming the Genesis account. I'm a believing Christian, but many intelligent design proponents have other worldviews. So the discussion of how to interpret those first chapters of Genesis, fascinating discussions, but that's not what intelligent design is about. It's certainly not the basis of the theory of intelligent design. Obviously, Christians who see evidence of intelligent design, Jews who see evidence of intelligent design, are going to be interested in relating what they see scientifically to what the scripture teaches. But that's a different kind of discussion. The theory of intelligent design is, again, it's a scientific hypothesis that we argue best explains the origin of certain features of biological, physical, and cosmological systems.
And the movie gets into some of that evidence in I must say, quite a vivid way and an easy to understand way for people like me who are not, you know, scientific experts. And that raises a question. Why did you call it The Story of Everything?
Well, one of our producers came up with that name. It's in a way a little bit of a nod to an earlier biopic about Stephen Hawking's life, which was called The Theory of Everything, and the fact that physicists keep seeking this all-inclusive, all-encompassing theory of everything, one single law that would, in their view, explain everything. But also, there's this sense that there's these two competing stories in Western culture going back to the ancient Greeks. One story says that pre-existing matter and energy have self-organized into all the things that we see. And another story says that, no, it wasn't pre-existing or self-existing matter and energy in the beginning or from eternity past, but rather there was a beginning to the physical universe. And that beginning was the product of a creative mind or intelligence. And so you have, and that the the complex living forms that we see arising later down the timeline in the history of the universe, in the history of our planet Earth, are themselves the product of the design of such a designing intellect. So you've got this mind over matter view, and you have the matter producing mind and everything else view. And those two stories of everything have been in conflict or in competition in Western culture for at least 2,500 years. And so when one of the producers came up with the idea of calling the film The Story of Everything, we thought it actually fit very well with what we're looking at, which is the competition between these two grand narratives, each of which claims to be based on scientific evidence.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you don't start with biology. You actually start with something else, which would be physics and how things came into being, the Big Bang, if you will. Why is the Big Bang, in your opinion, evidence of an intelligent designer?
Well, this was one of the just really shocking discoveries of the 20th century, Wesley. It was the 19 teens and 20s. There was a young American astronomer named Vesto Slipher who first noticed that the light coming from distant nebula, it was redder than it should be if the nebula were stationary in relation to us. If an object in the night sky is moving away from us, then the light rays coming from that will be stretched out and will have a longer wavelength. And the light coming from the nebula that we then later realized were actually distant galaxies is stretched out in just that way, indicating that those galaxies are moving away from us in every quadrant of the night sky, suggesting that the universe itself is expanding outward as if from some initial starting point. And as the analysis of that information proceeded, it became very clear that that's exactly what the evidence was pointing to, an initial beginning and then an expansion in the forward direction of time. And that blew people's minds because the assumption had been for a very long time in Western science and philosophy that the universe was eternal and self-existent, that it had no beginning and that it was infinite in temporal duration. And this conclusion was so distressing to Albert Einstein that he ended up gerrymandering his own equations, which also implied a beginning, to try to obscure that implication of his own work. He later
now, because I saw that in the movie and I was rather stunned because, you know, Einstein is held up as the epitome of rationality and objective science. And yet when his data and when his interpretation of the data interfered with a materialistic perspective, he tried to get out of it. Is that what you're saying?
Well, right, initially. But, you know, the great thing about Einstein is that he changed his mind and then said the three hardest words to say in the English language, which are, I was wrong. And I think that's the great hallmark of rationality, is being willing to change your mind when confronted with the evidence. But the story is fascinating. 1915, he develops the theory of general relativity, a new theory of gravity. It implies that massive bodies are literally curving space around, or what he called space-time, around the massive body. And he realizes that if gravity is the only force working in the universe, operating the universe, then all the matter in the universe should have congealed into one massive black hole. But he realizes we don't live in that kind of universe, so there must be some sort of countervening expansion force, an anti-gravity force, which he ended up calling the cosmological constant, that constantly outward pushing force that's creating the empty space. But if there's an outward pushing force, that implies that the universe is expanding outward, again, from some kind of a beginning. He finds that so distasteful as an idea that he posits that, well, not only that there's a cosmological constant, but he posits that the cosmological constant has a particular value. He fine-tunes the value so that he can portray the outward push and the inward pull as precisely balancing each other, and then for a time portray the universe as existing in an ecstatic state, a state of no beginning, no end. It just is.
And it doesn't change. Is that what you're saying?
What's that?
It doesn't change.
It doesn't change. No, it has no beginning and no end. It's just always been here. So that had been the view of philosophers and scientists coming into the 20th century.
But we now know, and certainly he knew, we have a dynamic universe.
Right. Well, he ended up coming around to that view. And again, there's a fascinating story because you think of science as just, you know, the men in white coats And the theory just jumps off the evidence and it's all very straightforward. But scientists typically have to have arguments about how to interpret the evidence to get to the right answer. And Einstein ends up in a spirited discussion with a Belgian physicist who is also a Catholic priest named Father George Lemaître. And Lemaître started working with Einstein's equations, and he showed that even with this gerrymandering that he'd done, they did not depict a stable universe. Instead, they depicted a dynamic universe. And moreover, the evidence from the astronomers, from Vesto Slipher and then later Edwin Hubble, was showing that the universe was actually expanding. So in the film, we show this famous newsreel footage where at the urging of other physicists, Einstein goes out to California, looks through the telescope, Hubble's telescope, and then 2 weeks later, he gives an interview to the New York Times and acknowledges that Hubble and his colleagues had shown that the universe was not static, but it was in fact dynamic and was expanding. And then he later said that his gerrymandering of his own equations was the greatest blunder of his life.
That's very interesting. And how, though, does that, I guess we could almost call it a fact that the universe is expanding. I mean, it's generally widely accepted. I don't believe in the scientific consensus says so it's true, but does anybody challenge that the universe is expanding anymore?
No, not really. There are a few people that have noticed that there are a few galaxies that are called blue shifted, where the light is not being stretched out, but it's coming towards us. But these are localized types of anomalies. And I don't think almost all astronomers accept not only that the universe was expanding, but there was a big bang. Where you find the debate now is among theoretical cosmologists who want to acknowledge that there was a big bang, but incorporate it into some type of larger model of a kind of bouncing universe that expands and contracts and expands and contracts ad infinitum. But there are some very deep problems with that arise with the math of theoretical physics, which we can talk about if you like. But I think pretty much everyone acknowledges that our universe had a beginning and it was expanding outward in the forward direction of time and is continuing to do so. And it is even accelerating in its rate of expansion, which suggests that there really won't be, it won't likely be a big recollapse, because the accelerating rate of expansion means that there's not enough gravitational mass to cause that recollapse.
So you're saying that the data, and this is for pure physics, one, shows that there was a big bang, which is a beginning, and I'm going to ask you why that's important. And two, that Woody Allen once in one of his movies said he's depressed because the universe is expanding. And I always thought that was very funny. But two, that the universe is expanding and that the amount of material in the world or in the universe isn't sufficient to make it contract, which would then suggest that the data of the contracting and expanding universe, it can't be demonstrated and based on the evidence we have today.
Yeah, that's right. The model you just described was something called the oscillating universe, which was popular into the mid-80s when it was determined that there's not enough matter in the universe to cause a subsequent gravitational recollapse. And that even if there were enough matter, and that counted the dark matter as well in those calculations, but that even if there were enough matter to cause a recollapse, you wouldn't get a subsequent bounce because you would have an entropy build-up problem, too much disorder, not enough energy left over to do work to cause the subsequent expansion. Now, there are today newer models of bouncing universes, but they run into problems, different types of problems. Either they violate something called the Borda-Guth-Vilenkin theorem, which showed that the universe, any universe in however many expansions and contractions that you have, if the universe is on average expanding, it will definitely have a beginning. The only way around that condition is to conceive of a model of expanding and contraction universes where there's not an overall increase in the volume of those universes over time, but those types of models run into the problem of the entropy buildup, suggesting that if the universe was truly infinite, if we've gone through an infinite number of those bounces, we should be at a state of complete heat death by now with maximum entropy disorder in the universe. We don't live in that kind of universe. Therefore, the universe is not infinitely old. So there's a kind of catch-22 associated with these bouncing universes. There have been some very powerful results in theoretical physics, in particular this one called the the Borda-Guth Vilenkin theorem, or known as BGV theorem, and it's a powerful indicator of a beginning. There are ways of getting around that, but getting around that theorem puts you into the teeth of other considerations that also imply the universe had a beginning. So there's a catch-22 for the materialistic cosmologist.
So when we think of intelligent design, we tend to think of biology. And we're talking before biology.
Yes, sure. That's right. Yeah.
And how does the apparent truth that there was a discrete beginning support the theoretical hypothesis of intelligent design?
Well, it's less about intelligent design than more about supporting a more generalized theistic argument, sometimes called the cosmological argument. You could think of that as a kind of intelligent design argument too, but this is an ancient argument. And the idea that there's a deductive form of the argument that says whatever begins to exist must have a cause. The universe had a cause. Since causes are separate from themselves, the cause of the universe must transcend the domains of matter, space, time, and energy. I end up making that argument in my book, Return of the God Hypothesis, in a slightly different form, not a deductive form, but a form of argument that is known as inference to the best explanation. The idea that if the universe, the physical universe of matter, space, time, and energy had a discrete beginning, then as we look for the best possible causal explanation, materialism fails as a possible causal explanation because what comes into existence is matter and energy at the beginning. So I like to say before the beginning of the universe, or maybe more precisely, independently of the beginning of the universe, there was no matter to do the causing. And so materialism really fails. Any kind of materialistic explanation fails to account for the origin of matter if matter came into existence a finite time ago. But instead, if you posit a mental reality, a mind with great power and a mind that transcends or is separate from the universe, you can explain the origin of the universe. So what I like to say is that the evidence for a beginning doesn't prove the existence of God, but the postulation of God provides the best explanation for the origin of the universe, the origin of the material universe of matter, space, time, and energy a finite time ago.
I have to say that when I was watching that part of the movie, the first law of thermodynamics kind of popped into my head, which says that energy cannot be created or destroyed, but just transferred to different systems. But doesn't the Big Bang violate that rule?
It does. In fact, it's the one exception. You know, matter and energy are neither created nor destroyed once they have been created, is I think the caveat that has to be added, because all the indications that we have are that the universe itself, the material universe of matter, space, time, and energy had a finite beginning. And therefore,
so the materialist, though, would say, well, wait a second, since you cannot create energy, energy has always existed, right?
Yeah, but unfortunately, the indications are that it has not always existed. So that the first law of thermodynamics applies to the matter and energy within our universe. It doesn't tell us whether the universe had a beginning or not. Other lines of evidence allow us to determine whether the universe had a beginning or not. And the multiple lines of evidence we have from observational astronomy, the redshift of the light from distant galaxies, the cosmic background radiation, information we have about the ages of galaxies, and many other lines of evidence, plus developments in theoretical physics, the BGV theorem that I was talking about, and also the singularity theorems, which don't prove, but point decidedly towards a beginning. I think you have a kind of preponderance of evidence pointing to a beginning of the universe. And I think that does support a theistic or maybe deistic conclusion over and against a materialistic explanation for the origin of the universe.
Some might say, and the Lord said, let there be light, and there was light.
Well, it has not escaped the notice of many top astronomers and theoretical physicists that the cosmology that has developed over the last 100 years, the Big Bang cosmology, is strikingly consonant with the Genesis account. The Genesis account has claimed that the universe had a beginning forever. Scientists doubted that for a very long time, and now our best science of 20th and 21st century is confirming that very claim that in the beginning, well, that there was a beginning. And even the idea that light plays a crucial role in the early part of the creation account. The universe apparently began in a kind of plasma state, and it persisted for about 380,000 years. And then at that point, cooled enough that light was emitted. And then you get this, at that point, brilliant coruscation of light coming out of the very earliest time in the universe. It's very nice with a Genesis account.
So Einstein, perhaps the greatest physicist who ever lived, tried to get out of a creator and a beginning and couldn't. And apparently Stephen Hawking did too. How did Stephen Hawking, who's another great physicist, a discoverer of black holes and so forth, how did he try to wiggle out of what you see as really strong evidence for a creator?
Right. Well, Hawking in the 1960s is a PhD student at the University of Cambridge. He's working on black hole physics, and black holes are places in the universe where there's a dense concentration of matter, so dense, in fact, that it's curving space so tightly that light, even light, can't get out. And Hawking begins to think about the implications of black holes and general relativity, Einstein's ideas about gravity for the new evidence that we have of the expansion of the universe. And he realizes that if the universe is expanding in the forward direction of time, that matter's getting more and more diffuse. But if you back extrapolate in your mind's eye, you realize that at every subsequent point in the past, matter would have been more and more densely concentrated, in which case the space around matter would be more and more tightly curved. And if you go back 1,000 years, 1,000,000 years, 1,000,000,000 years, however far back you go, the matter just gets more and more densely concentrated, the space gets more and more tightly curved, and eventually you reach a limiting case where the matter can't get any more densely concentrated and the space can't get more tightly curved. In fact, it goes to an infinitely tight curvature, which corresponds to zero spatial volume. So his singularity theorem, which he developed to express this idea, implies a beginning to the universe in a very powerful way. Now, there's a tiny little loophole that is associated with this way of thinking, and that is that inside a tiny volume called the Planck volume, or inside Planck time, when the universe is exceedingly tiny, the Planck time corresponding to that volume is, that would be 10 to the minus 43rd of a second after the beginning of the universe. Inside that little volume, quantum mechanical effects apply. That means there could be fluctuations into negative energies and all kinds of crazy stuff. But it means we don't really know how gravity would have worked in that tiny smidgen of space and time. And there, people have, as a result of that, people have said, well, maybe we don't know that general relativity applied all the way back to the very beginning, and so we can't know for sure that there was an absolute beginning. And instead, people have developed models that are known as quantum cosmological models. What they end up doing is portraying the universe as a what's called a superposition of possible states. In other words, there's a sort of a mathematical description of all the possible universes that could exist in this quantum realm, but that ends up being a kind of mathematical depiction of possibilities rather than an actual physical state. And you have this weird, weird conclusion then that the matter and energy of the universe expand out of a mathematical structure or equation of some kind. So you have matter.
But if there's an equation, doesn't there have to be somebody who created it?
Well, someone who's thinking it, at least. Yeah. Matter is conceptual. And one of the other inventors of quantum cosmology, Alexander Vilenkin, reflected very deeply on this. He said, before matter, space, time, and energy, what tablet are these quantum mechanical laws being written on? Math is the realm of the conceptual. So if we're saying that the matter and energy of the universe emerged out of this mathematical structure, are we really saying that a mind predated the universe? And we pick up on that theme in the film. And it's not only that there had to be matter, not only did the material universe come out of math, but the math has to be very carefully fine-tuned to get a universe like ours. And so for two reasons, it seems that the quantum cosmological models are implying a pre-existing mind, a mind that to think the mathematical equations and to conceive the possibilities that they reflect, and a mind to fine-tune the math that gives us a universe like ours. So the attempt to circumvent the beginning and its theistic implications has just led to theistic implications based on other grounds.
When you say zero spatial volume, you mean that it's literally nothing?
Nothing. This would be the idea of a true singularity at the beginning would be the idea of nothing. There'd be, I used to ask my students the question, how much stuff can you put in no space? And the answer is no stuff. And
zero times zero is zero.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So the singularity theorem, without taking into account the quantum mechanical kind of caveat, seems to be pointing to that kind of a beginning. I don't think you can prove that, but I think it's definitely pointing to that. It's interesting, in the technical papers of the quantum cosmologists who are developing this alternative to the singularity theorem based on general relativity, they themselves end up presupposing a singularity at the beginning in all their technical papers. In Hawking's Brief History of Time, in his popular work, he talked about getting rid of the idea of an absolute beginning, but he ends up acknowledging that it comes back when you reconvert his math out of the imaginary domain. And in his technical work, he presupposes an absolute singularity. But there are physicists and cosmologists who are trying to get away from that idea. But what I've argued and shown in the case of quantum cosmology is that those attempts themselves they imply theism for other reasons. It's a catch-22.
The materialists are in a snare that they cannot escape. I guess you could go to deism, where there's a creator that starts everything and then becomes indifferent to what happens.
Yeah, that's right.
But you can't escape that there has to be a creating event.
A creating event and a creator to generate the event. I think that's right. That is by far and away the best explanation of what we see. And the modeling that's going on right now to try to restore an infinite universe cosmology is extremely baroque. It's the physicists have to do double, turn themselves into pretzels to try to model the universe in a way that is still infinite and still consistent with the data we have pointing to a beginning.
So they continually violate Occam's razor, is what you're saying.
Occam's razor is grossly violated in these infinite universe cosmologies, and they all involve invoking new unexplained sources of fine tuning, which then needs to be explained. And if fine tuning is best explained by a fine tuner, which I think it is, they're right back to theism for other reasons.
Well, I could keep going with this, but we're beginning to run short on time. Let's move into the field of life. Do we have any idea how life began?
Not from a materialistic evolutionary point of view, no. But the fascinating thing about the inner workings of the cell is that it didn't turn out to be simple at all. In the 19th century, Thomas Henry Huxley, Darwin's famed bulldog, his most famous proponent, said that the cell is a simple homogeneous globule of undifferentiated protoplasm. And when scientists thought that the cell was just a little glob of jello in some kind of an enclosure, it was fairly easy to imagine how it might have arisen through a series of undirected chemical reactions, starting with simple chemistry. The cell has turned out to be anything but a simple homogeneous globule of undifferentiated protoplasm. Instead, it contains a complex information storage, transmission, and processing system where the information in the DNA molecule is processed with exquisitely complicated miniature machines. We have this exquisite realm of digital nanotechnology. The cell has been characterized as something like an automated factory that's run by code and which is processed by machinery. It's a mind-blowing level of integrated complexity. And for many, many reasons, it, I think, supports an inference to intelligent design.
Because of its complexity.
Well, the complexity and also the kind of information that's present in DNA. Bill Gates says it's like a software program, but much more complex than any we've ever created. We know that software comes from a mind. We know that the kind of information you have in software or written language is always the product of intelligence. And whenever we see information of that kind, whether it's in a hieroglyphic inscription or a paragraph in a book or the information in software or in a radio signal, and we trace information back to its source, we always come to a mind, not a material process. So the discovery of what's called functional or specified information, the kind of information we have in code and written language, the discovery of that kind of language or information in the living cell is, I think, a powerful indicator of the activity of a designing mind, a master programmer, as having played a role in the origin and the history of life.
So would the intelligent design hypothesis be that there's a creator, and without describing what that is, some would call it God, some might call it something else, that through means that we still don't know, began what we call life?
I would say yes. We're postulating the activity of an intelligent agent as the source of the information that's present in living systems, information which is necessary to the function of all living systems, right down to the one cell level. And we have the very dramatic event in the history of our planet where life first arises discreetly in the fossil record, and every one-celled organism that we've ever studied has that information processing system that we've been talking about inside it. So to explain the origin of life, you have to explain the origin of information. The origin of information is best explained as the product of a mind. Why? Because we know that only minds generate the kind of information that's present in the living system. That's what we know from our uniform and repeated experience, again, which is the basis of all scientific explanation. And so we have a very powerful indicator of the activity of a mind in the origin of life.
The movie doesn't get into, you know, the idea of how life moved from a single cell into complexity, into consciousness, at least with humans and so forth. But I did find one thing that Dawkins says in the film, because you do present opponents of your perspective in clips and so forth. He says that, quote, once Darwinism got going, you know, well, wait a second. What do you mean once Darwinism got going? You can't just say, well, there was nothing. Then Darwinism got going. And then once Darwinism got going, there was no purpose and life evolved through random processes. You can't do that.
Well, he just wants to leapfrog over the problem of the origin of the first life, the origin of the first self-replicating organism. You need self-replication to make natural selection work, but you can't invoke self-replication to explain the origin of life because that invokes a process that's only present once life has begun. So this is a deep philosophical and scientific conundrum for the evolutionary biologist. And Dawkins has previously acknowledged that we do not have an adequate chemical evolutionary theory of the origin of the first life. In other words, getting from the simple chemicals in the alleged prebiotic soup to the first living cell. That even leading evolutionary biologists, even proponents of neo-Darwinism like Dawkins, have to acknowledge and have acknowledged that is a completely unexplained transition from an evolutionary point of view.
I noticed in the film you had experiments that have been done to where they get this organic goo or whatever together, and then they try to stimulate it to create cells and so forth. And you point out, well, you have to have this intelligent interference with a natural process in order to get any kind of reaction.
Exactly. At every step of the way, you start with rarefied chemical starting materials that have been produced in a laboratory by intelligent chemists. You get them to react with each other. The byproducts of those reactions include things that would prevent any further reactions moving in a life-friendly direction. So you remove those byproducts, or else you simply start over again with the initial products of the reaction that would be favorable. It's called relay synthesis, and you just start a new reaction as if there were no deleterious byproducts that would prevent things from going forward, and you take it one step after another like that. So it's all intelligently designed. We've never designed life in the laboratory, let's be clear, not even close. But even to get the simple chemicals to move in a more life-friendly direction, there has to be the imposition of a great deal of information into the biological, in the biochemical system, and that's always coming as an intervention of an intelligent chemist. Now, all these experiments, interestingly, Wesley, have a name. They're called simulation experiments. And the logic of them is based on something called uniformitarian reasoning, the idea that the present is the key to the past. So they want to simulate something in the present that would allow them to make conclusions about what must have happened in the past. But in every one of those simulation experiments, there's an indispensable role for intelligence to move the chemistry in a life-friendly direction. Well, if that's the case, Jim Tour, the leading biochemist or organic chemist at Rice University, and I have asked, well, then what's being simulated? Aren't you therefore simulating the need for intelligent design in the to move from chemistry to code and to move from chemistry to life? I think that's exactly what's being simulated. And often the simulator becomes inured or unaware as blinders to the indispensable role of his own intelligence in moving the chemistry in the right direction.
The irony is delicious.
It is, I think. I agree.
One of the aspects of the movie, and I urge everyone to see it, it's more than 2 hours long, actually.
1 hour, 37 minutes, actually.
1 hour. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right. Correct.
I was just on with Hugh Hewitt, and he was relieved to know that the film was just over an hour and a half. He said, "Oh, I thought you were going to say there was so much to explain. We had to go long. It was 2.5 hours." He says, "No, it's very watchable. It's only an hour and a half and a smidge." So
it's 1 minute, including credits. It's 1 hour and 41 minutes or so.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
My math stinks, which is why I became a lawyer. One of the things in the movie that surprised me was that you have a place for beauty as evidence of a creating agent. How does beauty come into this?
Well, we just touched on this in the end, and we were looking so much at molecules and things deep out in space. We wanted to look at whole organisms and had a sequence of shots. I'm an avid snorkeler and love to go to the Hawaiian Islands to look at those beautiful tropical fish. And they're just exquisitely almost painted. One of the species is called a Picasso triggerfish. You have these beautiful designs that seem to have absolutely nothing to do with the survival of the fish. If anything, they're saying to the predators, "Hey, here I am, come eat me," you know. But it's a problem in evolutionary theory known as gratuitous beauty. Beauty in tropical fish and butterflies, in the coloration of bird wings, whatever it is. A beauty that doesn't seem to have anything to do with conferring a survival advantage on the organism. The Darwinian mechanism of mutation and natural selection is essentially a utilitarian mechanism that's just maximizing certain traits for their survival utility. But there are many, many features of the biological world that seem to have absolutely nothing to do with the utility of the organism for survival, but rather it's a beauty of a gratuitous kind from the standpoint of survivability. And this is a problem within evolutionary theory. And I think it's readily explained by the idea that there was a designer who was not only a great programmer and engineer, but an artist as well.
Beauty's, as they say, is in the eye of the beholder. It seems to me that the very concept is exclusive to the human realm. I'm not sure. You correct me if I'm wrong, but if you have a beautiful, you have plumage that sometimes attracts female birds to male birds, but if there's gratuitous beauty, does anyone appreciate that beauty other than us?
It's hard to say, but
anything.
We certainly do. And this is one of the things that the scientists in the film, Richard Sternberg, said. He said it's as if it's reaching out to us. It's calling our attention to it. And I think that's an interesting observation. And you're right to mention that there are explanations involving sexual selection, that the beauty we perceive in nature has an evolutionary explanation in that it is attracting mates. And you can explain some of it that way, but you have all these, for example, all these different patterns, beautiful patterns in the tropical fish in Hawaii that I mentioned. It's hard to say that any one of those has any differential value in attracting a mate or helping the organism to survive over any other. They're extremely intricate, and the beauty doesn't seem to have a direct correlation to anything that aids the fish in survival. If anything, it may attract predators.
Does the hypothesis that you propose assert that all of this is designed for us humans?
Well, I think it does. I think there's a passage in the scripture, one of the Psalms, that says the. Or maybe it's Isaiah. It says that God designed the earth so that it would be inhabited, is the phrase. There is a sense of that. I think the intelligent design hypothesis in its most basic form is simply affirming that we see features in the living world, we see features in physics that, based on our knowledge of cause and effect in the universe, are best explained by the activity of a designing mind. From that point, I think then you can begin to think, well, what kind of a mind are we talking about? If we have evidence of a mind that generated the whole universe. We're clearly not talking about a mind that is immanent within the cosmos. If we're talking about, we see evidence that there is design that arises after the beginning of the universe. That's not evidence that can be explained by a deistic conception of a creator. So I think you can rule out aliens and deistic creators as providing the best explanation. I think it's something like a theistic creator. I don't know how much further you can go from that. But if you think about just how beautiful things are, you might want to say, well, the creator has an appreciation of beauty. There's an artistry. I think there's some other inferences you can draw, but the basic inference to design is simply to that of a creative intelligence.
And, you know, there's a lot of talk these days about UFOs, are known as UAPs, unidentified anomalous phenomena.
Yes.
Which, who knows what they are, but in this vast universe, there must be great beauty and there must be things happening in the galaxies that are a billion light years away. So just because there's a creator here, and it would seem to you, from your perspective, at least point toward us as the subject, doesn't mean that there aren't other subjects. Right?
We aren't drawing any inferences about that one way or another. I will say that it used to be thought among physicists and cosmologists and astronomers that the vastness of the universe suggested that there must be life someplace else besides just here. In my book, I mentioned that there are 200 billion galaxies. I've been corrected. It's actually another order of magnitude beyond that. It's a trillion galaxies that we think exist in the visible universe. And it was thought that the vastness of the universe with all those galaxies and all those possible solar systems and all those possible planets meant that there had to be some other planets somewhere that had life-friendly, life-sustaining conditions. There have been astronomers now challenging that idea, not challenging the vastness of the universe, but they're challenging it on the grounds that the number of conditions that have to be just right and the collective improbability of those conditions is so small that that improbability dwarfs even the vastness of the probabilistic resources that you would have because of all the other planets and galaxies in the universe.
Is this a fine-tuning argument?
Well, it's a fine-tuning about the universe itself, but also what's called planetary or localized fine-tuning. That getting a planetary system like ours with a planet like planet Earth turns out to depend on many, many, many parameters that have to fall in very many sweet spots. And the collective improbability of that is almost infinitesimally small. So if you're saying that the probability is that there must be another life-friendly planet someplace, well, you have to balance the number of possible planets against the number of things that you have to get right and the improbability associated with all those things. And so that's now an open question, I think. There was a book called Rare Earth a few years ago by two University of Washington astronomers arguing that, well, this is not at all an open and shut case that there are other life-friendly planets. And our colleagues Jay Richards and Guillermo Gonzalez have also raised that point in their book Privileged Planet. So I think that's an open question. What I would argue is not an open question is that if there is life elsewhere, it would depend on information and information processing. This is just, in order to get self-replication, there is a minimal informational requirement, and self-replication being a feature of life, you've got to have information. And again, since information is always a mind product, if there is life elsewhere, it too would manifest evidence of a designing intelligence.
So, you know, we're made out of carbon molecules, but that doesn't mean all life would have to be made out of carbon molecules. In fact, isn't there some life here on Earth that isn't made out of carbon molecules?
There isn't any life here that is not carbon-based. And Fred Hoyle considered that possibility a long time ago and thought about, well, could you have silicon-based life? Well, it turns out that carbon has unique properties that allow it to form long chain-like molecules that are capable of carrying information. And of all the possible elemental substrates for life, it is by far and away the best and maybe the only that has those type of properties. And so one of the big physics discussions has been, how do you explain the abundance of carbon in the universe? And it turns out there are a whole set of fine-tuning parameters that are necessary to make carbon possible. That was one of the things that turned Fred Hoyle from his previous scientific atheism to embrace his version of intelligent design, where he was quoted as saying that a common sense interpretation of the fine-tuning evidence suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics and chemistry in order to make life possible. So,
It's interesting. You've been in the trenches of these issues for decades, and you were subject to terrible vituperation when this started. But it seems to me that you're beginning, not you necessarily individually, but the movement that you're, I think, leading is beginning to prevail.
I sense the same thing, Wesley. And part of what we sense is that we're attracting more and more young scientists into our summer programs, into our movement. The pace of peer-reviewed publication is growing exponentially in support of intelligent design. The quality of the scientists that are the senior scientists that are affiliating or involving themselves in research based on intelligent design is just breathtaking. My last book, Return of the God Hypothesis, had endorsements from eight endowed university professors of science who hold endowed chairs and one Nobel laureate. So the idea that this is inherently scientifically disreputable, I don't think can be sustained. We were called creationists and cheap tuxedos and all sorts of things like that. I did notice someone sent me the other day, I was actually kind of flattered. There's this guy on the internet named Professor Dave who has made a living attacking people who advance this. He's attacked Jim Tour, who has 850 peer-reviewed publications in top science journals and 150 patents. And Professor Dave has tried to portray Jim Tour as cognitively challenged. He's got a new video about me up. I haven't watched it yet, but the thumbnail is Stephen Meyer is an idiot. And so these are the kind of attacks you welcome because they're self-incriminating. If people resort to that kind of insult and ad hominem abuse, I think most people see through that right away. So,
yeah, it's kind of like patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, I may well be an idiot, but I can tell you that Jim Tour isn't, and Gunter Beckley wasn't, and William Dembski with two PhDs, one in math from the University of Chicago, is not an idiot. And all these people are also coming in for the same kind of abuse. So I'm in good company.
In the end, though, whether it's material or immaterial, creator or a static universe that has always existed, what difference does it make to us in our everyday lives?
Well, I think the evidence of a creation event does point to a creator. The alternative view is that we are the product of purely undirected, unguided material processes, which will continue to devolve over time and eventually produce a heat death of the universe. This is what physics projects, in which case there will be no minds, no conscious awareness of anything. And nothing can mean anything to an atom or an elementary particle or a rock or even to a DNA molecule. Things only mean things to persons with conscious awareness. So the materialistic vision of the future, the materialistic story of everything, is that things started from purposeless processes and will end in a purposeless heat death in which nothing can mean anything to anyone. There is no ultimate meaning to our existence. There's no one there to mean anything. But if there is a purposeful creator behind the universe, and if that purposeful creator's existence extends beyond our brief time on Earth, then the possibility of there being ultimate meaning is back on the table. And I think the Judeo-Christian answer has always been that creator is a loving being and that we find meaning in relation to him and in relation to the other creatures with creative minds and conscious awareness that he has created. And so I think what's at stake is nothing less than whether or not there can be ultimate meaning in the universe. And I think many young people in particular, I certainly did when I was younger, have this kind of angst about whether or not there was anything was going to mean anything. That was my big question. What's going to mean anything in 100 years? What will anything matter? What's it going to matter in 100 years? It was all about meaning. There's a Harvard study out showing that a large number, I think it's over 50% of young people have acknowledged having persistent doubts about whether their own lives have any enduring or lasting meaning or purpose. And I think that's a direct byproduct of this materialistic, nihilistic worldview that claims to be based on science, but is not based on science. And that is the burden of proof we assume in the film. And the film being based on my book, Return of the God Hypothesis, it's a burden of proof that I assume. I think this, the best evidence we have from cosmology, from physics, from biology is pointing to a prior designing mind behind the universe. And if that's the case, as I said, I think that the issue of meaning is back on the table.
And if there is a designing mind, there is always the hope that we can connect with it.
Exactly right. And perhaps even the idea that there may be life beyond our brief time on Earth as well, that there's a hope of an afterlife as conferred. If there's a creator who could confer life on us in the first place, then such a being could confer such life on us in eternally, as the Judeo-Christian scriptures discuss.
Particularly when there's now evidence that the human mind isn't necessarily material.
Well, then you need an interview. Maybe you had one with Michael Egner, I think.
I have had one with Michael Egner, yes.
Exactly.
Well, Steve, thank you very much for being on the podcast. What next in your busy schedule?
I'll be teaching a course this summer in Cambridge, England, and that's a very exciting endeavor with a lot of young up-and-coming scientists and scholars from different disciplines about these very issues.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for being on Humanize, and we'll talk to you again.
Thank you very much, Wesley. Always good to be with you.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.